Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
To HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. This next segment of our show, Senator Peter Beam will be telling us a little bit about his advocacy efforts.
So, I understand recently you've been in talks with Every Canadian Counts about a long-term accessibility initiative. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, thank you. Yes, I have been in conversation with Every Canadian Counts and with other groups and individuals as well. And much of this discussion began before the pandemic hit us, and so I think the, in a sense, the pandemic sort of knocked us to the side in terms of furthering the conversations, including conversations I would then have with other parliamentarians, other legislators, to see how we can move forward on moving on a disability insurance program, if that is the collective wish, and also on a few other items that are important to me, such as autism in Canada.
So, in that sense, I'm aware that you've done a lot of international work and basically seen the world. So, what are some of the key accessibility challenges you've seen in your efforts?
Well, when I lived abroad and acted abroad, it was of course on the foreign policy, international trade, and security issues. So less so on social policy issues, but it did give me an opportunity to learn what, by living abroad, and what other countries and other jurisdictions were doing. So, for example, when I was ambassador to Germany, we had our son with us, who is an autistic Canadian, and we were looking for supports for him there. And in Germany, they have supports that we do not have in Canada, including the possibility of vocational training and the like. Now, the vocational training did not work out for our son, but in any event, I learned a lot in terms of how things can be applied. Ditto too, living in Washington, D.C., there were opportunities for him and for others who are disadvantaged autistic people. And so I learned a lot through that, and also on the jurisdictional issues, because in countries like ours, you have a federal and a provincial need for collaboration, and that can be a challenge sometimes. It can also be very satisfying. That is kind of my experience in living and working abroad.
So, do you ever encounter any myths or stereotypes concerning autism?
Well, of course, there are many there. First of all, the notion that all autistic people are alike. No, everyone is an individual. Everyone can manifest the disorder in different ways. Not everyone is a Dustin Hoffman, Rain Man type character who will know all of these statistics. Many autistic people are nonverbal, cannot express themselves and need supports of different varieties. And that goes, I think, for any disability.
So, are there any steps we as citizens can take on a day-to-day basis to better educate ourselves and just raise our own awareness in interacting with someone with disability?
Of course there are. There's a wealth of information out there, certainly on the web. There's a lot of disinformation, too. And there are certain stigmas associated with disabilities, whether it is language that was used in the past that is considered insulting today, or just coming to realize that these are individuals who have aspirations and desires that should be accommodated. We have, of course, the knowledge that we have a demographic shift in Canada and in many countries with an aging population, and that means that those who might be disabled, who are older, are going to need different supports than the supports that were offered up until now. So I think there are a lot of emerging pressures out there in terms of population growth. There's also the intersectional aspect, and that by intersectional I mean it's gender, it is color, it is the question of just the diverse nature of societies and different cultural mores that come to play so often. I think in the past, and to an extent today, if you do have a disabled individual in your let's say in your household or in your inner circle, in some cultures there's been a tendency to hide that. I think there should be greater openness in terms of addressing the issue, the problem, and the supports that can be offered.
So, if you could see anything added to the supports that exist today, what would it be?
I think we've learned something from this pandemic, and of course it's not over yet, but I think we've learned that there has to be better jurisdictional cooperation, certainly to Canada, between the federal and the provincial levels. A lot of that has taken place. A lot of it has been made up on the fly. There still remain challenges. I think, too, that we've learned that you cannot have a hospital-type situation or institutional approach to everything, that the issue of home care is really important. I think on data, we need to share data better. There are a lot of reports that are out there already in terms of how this could be done, and for governments, whether federal or provincial, to commission yet another report and study this even more. I think that wastes time. I think we have a lot of knowledge and a lot of expertise out there. We need to share it, and we need to act on it.
So, what are the next steps forward in your advocacy efforts?
Well, there are a number of things that are going on. There are some parliamentarians who are pushing the government to look at disability insurance or a mental disability type program that is nationwide, working with the provinces. There's a bill in the Senate that Senator Houtsakos has sponsored, and I am supporting strongly, that would set out and push the federal government to set out a framework for autism, for Canadians with autism. In other words, that the federal government could, within that framework, then develop a national autism strategy, working with the provinces, not doing more studies, but actually acting and doing things, allocating funds as appropriate. That would be part of the strategy, obviously. So there's an interest amongst parliamentarians to push forward. There's an interest amongst Canadians. The pandemic has obviously been a huge factor in terms of distracting the policy work. We have to get through that. But I'm optimistic that we can do more looking ahead.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure. Thank you very much.
Of course.
In this segment of our show, Leanne Melk-Zarek will be telling us a little bit about Lupus Canada.
Just tell me a little bit about Lupus Canada.
Yeah, Lupus Canada, we're the only national organization that's focused on lupus research, advocacy, awareness, and education in Canada. We're fiercely committed to improving the lives of people living with lupus, their families, and their loved ones by investing in various initiatives that bring us closer to dedicated treatments and hopefully ultimately one day a cure. We're run by three full-time staff and a diverse volunteer group of board of directors.
So, for those who might not be as familiar, how can lupus affect a person's life?
Sorry, how does lupus affect a person's life? Did I hear that correctly?
You did, yes.
Okay, wonderful. Okay, well, people ask, what is lupus? We hear that a lot because it's not as well known, and we are working to increase the public awareness of what lupus is. But imagine being in a state of constant fatigue with flu-like symptoms. That's lupus. Imagine when we have all been experiencing for the last number, almost 2 years, living with COVID in our environment. Imagine living with lupus and having the fear of COVID. So that's how, when a person is living with lupus, they feel like they're isolated because they're always in fear of getting sick. And that is how, that's how we associate with people who have, we've all experienced what it's like living with this society of COVID. It's that fear of getting sick. So it's the isolation. Lupus is a chronic autoimmune disease that can damage any organ in the body in any individual at any time in their lives. The cause remains unknown, and a cure currently does not exist. 80% of patients develop lupus between 15 and 44 years of age, and it can take up to 7 years for diagnosis, and patients are left without proper treatments, which adversely impacts their overall health. It can range from mild to life-threatening. 90% of people with lupus can be women, but we're seeing more men and children with this disease. The symptoms for lupus patients is staggering. It can be such a variety of different symptoms.
So, in terms of the isolation you mentioned, gotta imagine there's a severe mental health impact that goes along with it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. For some, when we talk about lupus being the disease of a thousand faces, because it affects everybody so differently, can affect some people more severely, some less severely, depending on the organ involvement. And we do also see that it has an impact on mental health because of the isolation, and because it can take a number of years to be diagnosed. And we hear from lupus patients saying that my doctor doesn't think I have lupus. The tests aren't coming back conclusive. They think it's more of a psychological thing. What are my next steps? What do I do? That is a big part of it. Once they're diagnosed with lupus, trying to explain the symptoms and how people are feeling to their family, to their friends. Some people may say, oh, you're lazy. No, I'm living with lupus, and this is a condition. And I am, you know, suffering from a multitude of symptoms. But because on the outside I look okay, doesn't mean on the inside I'm okay.
So, do you know offhand about how many people are affected?
It's a very tough number to determine because there hasn't been a study done recently, but we were saying 1 in 1,000 Canadians, but of more recently we've heard more like 2 in 1,000, so the number is significant.
So, in your time with Lupus Canada, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
Yeah, I would say I've been with Lupus Canada myself for about 13 years now, and throughout the years, one thing I really look back on and see in the last number of years is we're really creating that awareness for lupus. We're seeing more and more people understand what this disease is. We're having people like yourselves wanting to learn more about the disease and be able to share that with all Canadians. So I really think we've made great strides when it comes to creating awareness for lupus. We also, at Lupus Canada, we support different initiatives like research. So we are supporting folks through our Catalyst Grant program, which helps to look at different potential studies around lupus and so that we can help those researchers make a difference. We also are advocating for lupus patients to ensure that they have access to care and access to medications. And we are seeing that there's more medications on the horizon for lupus patients. So that's very exciting news in the world of lupus. It was I think 11 or 12 years ago when we heard of the first new medication, which was Benlysta, which, you know, that was back in 2011. And it was 50 years since there was a new medication. So we're seeing more pharma companies focus in this field, which is very exciting news.
So if you could send any message to the community about the need to keep pushing forward in research and advocacy, what would you say?
We really need to keep the awareness going so that people understand what lupus is and people understand what people are living with, so that that it's the understanding. And I always believe that with the understanding and the awareness of lupus, everything else will come. And we want to be able to continue to support these important vital initiatives that we're working on, which are, as I mentioned, advocating for the lupus patient and their caregivers. Their caregivers also live through a lot of this and have their own components to this. Also, to continue to support research. Research is vital. And to create the awareness first and foremost for lupus so that we can best support lupus patients and their family and their caregivers.
So I'd imagine that in terms of advocacy, and as you mentioned, the fatigue element, there's got to be an impact on things like employment and income and ability to work.
Absolutely. For some, it's very difficult to work a full-time job because with fatigue and their symptoms, it just is almost impossible. Because it is a disease of 1,000 faces, there are some that are able to work full-time and be very successful. However, there's a large group of folks that, you know, that is just not something that's in their cards. It's just too difficult with the fatigue and the symptoms that, you know, if they can work part-time or work at all, it can be very challenging for a lot of folks who are living with lupus. So it's important that employers understand what lupus is so they can best assist their employees and that they're making available, through insurance, that they can have access to the medications, because medications can be costly. So there's that sort of, you know, whole sort of cyclical issue where if I can't work, how do I afford my medications? And we want to make sure that, you know, that everybody has access to care.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Wonderful, thank you.
Of course. Handy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Whether you're on the go or staying home, make CJAM the soundtrack to your day. Tune into 99.1 FM on your radio or visit cjam.ca to listen live or access past shows. You can also stream us right from iHeartRadio. Just visit iHeartRadio.ca or download the iHeartRadio app. And if you feel like it, connect with us on social media. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all at CJAM FM. Keep yourself close to the music. CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching higher ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Leanne Melkzarek about Lupus Canada, and Senator Peter Bean told us a little bit about his experiences with accessibility. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Ben Fulton, will be telling us a little bit about an accessibility awareness campaign. So, can you tell me a little bit about your advocacy efforts and your work with CFB?
Okay, yeah. Currently I'm a member of the Canadian Federation of the Blind. It's an advocacy organization here in Canada. They believe firmly in philosophy that blindness is a characteristic that does not define the individual and does not limit you, and that blind people are capable of accomplishing anything. They may just go about it in different ways. So it's a very empowering organization of the blind, for the blind. And I've been working with them for about 2, maybe 3 years now as a member. And right now I'm working with them to pursue a challenge to some legislation here in Ontario.
So I'd love some details about legislation you'd hope to see enacted.
Well, in this case, we're looking to change some legislation that's currently in action. The Human Rights Code of Ontario, it's a great piece of legislation in many ways. Section 2 of that legislation provides people the right to be equal with respect to, services and accommodations like renting, houses, places to live, and to be free from discrimination for, a number of the reasons that we, as Canadians, feel, are not valid reasons to discriminate, like sex, sexuality, gender, race, religion, and in my case, disability. The problem with the Human Rights Code of Ontario is that Section 21, Sub 1 of that legislation, removes that protection from people who are looking to rent a room in a house that is shared by a landlord or a family member of the landlord. And because a lot of the affordable housing is shared housing, people like myself who are looking for, reasonably priced accommodations, are looking into the, shared housing market, especially as this intersects with disability and other minority groups. People are really in need of this kind of housing. And unfortunately, landlords are allowed to refuse to rent to people because they have a disability or because they, any reason the landlord wants, really. So we're trying to change that legislation so that landlords who are looking to rent out a room in their house are held to that same standard of other landlords, where they're not allowed to discriminate against people who are seeking to rent that affordable accommodation. This blanket exception that allows landlords to discriminate on, no reason at all, really, just because they feel like it. And this has affected me when I was looking to rent affordable accommodations as a student near the university.
So, can you take us through a little bit of that story and how it's impacted you?
Yeah, so I came to Toronto in 2015 as a student, ready to, start taking classes at Osgoode Hall Law School, and I was looking for a place to rent near campus that would be very affordable. Being a student, I didn't need a lot, so shared accommodations was a perfect fit, and there was a lot of shared accommodations in an area kind of colloquially referred to as the village, or the student village, just south of the university there. And there's a lot of housing there, a lot of it's shared housing, and a lot of it is, in that $400 or $500 price range. Prices might have gone up a little now since 2015, of course. And I started experiencing discrimination, really for the first time in a big way in my life ever. The first place I went to rent, I thought was, perfect. It had been lined up over the phone. I talked to the landlord, and I showed up with a friend of mine, and I think when the person saw that I was blind, they didn't want to rent to me on that reason alone. The reason they gave was that they said that somebody had, showed up just 2 hours before and had put a deposit on the room. Even though I called, just before we drove over, and she said that the room was still available at that point. So, when me and my friend, we were walking away from the house, she was kind of like, I think she's just doesn't want to rent to you because you're blind. And as I continued to look for places, that kind of pattern started reoccurring, and actually the first place that I was able to find, the landlord did rent to me, but made me sign a waiver agreeing not to, you know, sue him if anything should happen, like, say, were I to fall down the stairs. Now, I've never fallen down the stairs, and, you know, I signed the waiver because I really needed a place to rent, and I kept a copy of it as, you know, proof to support my case to the tribunal that this discrimination is very real, it's happening, it's very prevalent, and, you know, something really needs to be done about it.
So, in that sense, with the legislation you're working to get adjusted, what would be the ideal outcome?
Well, ideally, I'd like to strike down that part of the provision of the code that allows this discrimination. Just to tell the listeners a little more about what happened to me, this pattern repeated itself in second year and third year as I needed to find a place for each successive year of housing. And in my third year, it got so bad that, you know, I looked for so many places, I started telling landlords before I showed up that I was blind, just to save myself the aggravation of showing up to another place and getting some kind of flimsy excuse as to why they wouldn't rent me. Sometimes they would actually tell me to my face that they didn't want to rent me because I was blind, but I didn't feel like that would be a strong enough case. So I was communicating with one landlord in text messages, and when it got to the point where, okay, come and look at the place, I disclosed that I was blind, and I got a text message back saying that they didn't want to rent to me because I was blind. They said they couldn't afford it. So I offered to get insurance. I offered to sign a waiver like I had with the other landlord. They were unresponsive, and I felt like I had enough evidence to go forth with a case to the Human Rights Tribunal. And that's when, you know, Section 21, Sub 1, prevented me from going any further, because the type of accommodation the landlord was providing was shared accommodation. The landlord shares this room, is renting out a room in their own house, so they share the kitchen and the bathroom with the tenants. And, you know, until that legislation is changed, this kind of discrimination will continue to exist. It will be deemed valid. It'll be considered legal. So until we change that legislation, this is the unfortunate situation that individuals with disability and, you know, members of other minority groups have to live with while they, you know, seek housing in the affordable housing market. We know there's a housing crisis, and we know that there's not enough affordable housing to go around, and now there's this barrier preventing people who really need that kind of housing. So ideally, I'd like to have that provision, Section 21, Sub 1 of the Ontario Human Rights Code, struck down, or, you know, basically removed from the code.
So you wanted to mention about stories being gathered by the CFB.
Yeah, so that organization I'm working with, the Canadian Federation of the Blind, on their website, they have a link for people to report incidents that they themselves have experienced with discrimination in housing, specifically shared accommodations. I basically heard kind of through the grapevine about this happening, but we don't really have any, you know, firsthand accounts from people, you know, willing to share their story, willing to say that this has happened to them and they've experienced this themselves. Yeah, I know that it exists, but having other people's stories will be more compelling and make our case a lot stronger when we bring this, you know, to the court to challenge this legislation. So I am asking the listeners if they have any experiences themselves or know anybody who's experienced this kind of discrimination to go onto the Canadian Federation of the Blind website, to click that link, to, you know, tell your story and help us, you know, fight this legislation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yeah, absolutely.
To many of us, being told outright that we're being discriminated against solely because of our disability would spark an incredible need for justice. That need never be silenced by those who would tell us we are not to be included. Push forward, understand and acknowledge you are a capable, worthy human being. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you have earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.